the environmental studies program, and send students there. We do the work to make the farm run. The nonprofit supplies all the stuff to make the farm run. This arrangement has actually worked out to be very clean and done it. It's worked out really well for us. It's worked out well because the university, it's a liberal arts university, it's not a land grant, they don't have very much land. They don't want to be in the farming business. They want to be in the education business. My boss in environmental studies has said that to me in just those clear words. They want to see really good student evaluations. They want to see good press. They want to see really good community involvement. But he doesn't care about how I plant carrots or whether I use a spader or a disc or anything like that. Just wants to see good student evaluations. Doesn't want to be in the farming business. They don't want to have to think about how much money should we spend on carrot seed or fuel or whatever, because they don't spend money like that for other classes, at least not to that degree. The nonprofit, on their hand, is designed all around food security. The nonprofit has three missions. The first mission is to get high-quality food to low-income people. The second mission is to create opportunities in education for ecologically conscious agriculture. The third one is to use our sites, because the nonprofit has 4 big sites now, for the personal restoration of troubled youth and adults. So there's a social service angle as well. So these two entities work together. We have a CSA that has 90 members. We send about 15,000 pounds of food to the food bank annually. The nonprofit manages the CSA, distributes the food, and sends the food off to the food bank. On the university side, the students are there as a class. This is the other part of it that I think it's unique. In conversations with lots of people here over the last day and a half, heard lots of descriptions of paying students or having students be work study or all sorts of different iterations of how do you get students to the farm. And I imagine in each case, everyone has designed something that works really well for them. And I pass no judgment on saying ours is a different model. But after doing this for a bunch of years, I really believe that the educational experience that students have at the farm is really, really special and super powerful, much more so than your typical classroom experience. And they're in college. They're there for just this kind of thing. I've come up with my own little definition of education that, of course, matches my other agenda. And that is, education is an experience that should send you down a path to work thoughtfully and passionately for a better world. And that's exactly what happens with the student farm experience. So I feel unhesitatingly excited and positive and like we're doing the right thing by saying, come to the farm for the summer. You're going to work 20 hours a week. We're going to blend academics and hands-on work. And you're going to pay for this experience. You'll get 6 credits for it. We're not struggling with figuring out how do we pay people. If we wanted to pay people to work at the farm, I would be thinking, what's the very best way to get this work done? We're hiring people. We would not hire college kids. We would hire professional farm workers. But it's not about that. At the same time that it's not about that, it kind of is about that. We have a CSA, and we have this obligation to the food bank. So we have production obligations that are very real. So if we have these real production obligations, why in the heck are we having students and not the professional farm workers, right? Well, it's my thesis, it's my belief that the intensity, the real production obligations, actually make the educational experience better, that there's a creative tension here. There are obvious teachable moments, but there are times when we cannot do teachable moments. We have CSA twice a week. We have weather windows where it's going to rain. We got to get this in. And it's not the time to talk about the difference between hard-neck garlic and soft-neck garlic. But there are times when you can do that. Like, I'm repeating myself, but that intensity, the production obligations make the education better because the students realize that the exercise is not academic. This isn't about, well, whatever we bring to the dining hall, they'll use. It's about people who have paid $500 for this food and they're coming at 4:30 and it darn well better be on the table and beautiful and treated perfectly. So when they walk into our barn building, they go, whoa, which is absolutely what we want to happen. So the education is made better by the production obligations and by that production intensity. And I would say, vice versa, that the production is made better by the education. So the students are there to learn, right? Well, their learning is going to make the production better. If they actually understand a bit about the garlic I was talking about, they're going to do a little better job of planting it, or they'll be that much more engaged in planting it. That was more than I was going to explain just about the background of our farm, but I wanted to touch on what I feel like are some of the unique models behind it. What I wanted to talk about, or what this session is really about, is how a farm can be a force for community development. And I came up with my own little words for this, just because I have lots of time in my head on the tractor, calling it civic agriculture. So the goal here is not just food production, or even education, which is for this somewhat limited group, but it's actually to make our town better. And lots of towns getting better makes the world better. Well, public student farms are almost by definition public places. And I think as so, they're uniquely situated to do some great community development. So there's three main ways that our farm interacts with the community. The first one is through the food we grow. The second one is through the experience of growing food. And the third one is by being part of the larger community. And I'm going to talk a bit about each of these three things, focus a bit more on the student experience side, and then I'll show pictures. I'm not much of a PowerPointer. I'd much rather just talk. And often when I'm sitting where you're sitting and the lights go down, I really have a hard time staying awake. So I'm going to try and grip your attention before we get to pictures. So the first way that we interact with the community, that we can do community development, is through the food that we grow. Like I said, we send 15,000 pounds of food to the food bank. We also do two other ways that we're involved in getting food to the community. One of them is we have a program called Volunteer for Veggies. So anybody can come up from the community and volunteer on the farm. They put in 4 hours of work, and they get half a CSA share. 8 hours of work, they get a whole CSA share. They just have to tell us the day before the CSA harvest that they're coming, so we harvest the right amount of food. This is a great thing because people don't have to have a big, giant commitment to it. You can just show up and do a little bit of work. It's really great for students because students get to interact with people they wouldn't otherwise interact with. We had some wonderful Volunteer for Veggies people this year, older people. It's great to see older people working with younger people. The other way that we interact with the community, and this isn't directly with the Pease Farm, but with Garden City Harvest, is that we have four other neighborhood farms. Missoula is actually an urban place. I'll show you a picture later. You think Montana, you think rural. This place is actually much more rural. Montana is more remote. People are concentrated in population centers surrounded by vast expanses of open space. Then there's another population center. Missoula is just that, 70,000 people in a little bowl in a valley. So we put four other neighborhood farms strategically located in low-income neighborhoods where you have half or three-fourths of the land at the neighborhood farm is managed as a farm by one person, and then we have community garden plots. So people have the opportunity to get our food by going to the food bank to get food from the Pease Farm. They can volunteer for veggies, trade their hours for food at any of the neighborhood farms, or they can get a community garden plot. So food, okay, that's fine, right? Well, it's way more than just nutrition. I want to unpack this a little bit. This is all around getting food to people who don't have a lot of money. First, I want to say there are a lot of people like that. I just read this the other day in the transcript of a Bernie Sanders speech. 21.6% of American children live in poverty, 21.6. And that should sound like, man, that's a lot. That's like one in five, right? That's a lot of people. But relatively speaking, what does that mean? Well, the social democracies of Northern Europe are all in the single digits, some lower than 5%. We are half a percentage point away from Mexico. And look at our actual total wealth compared to a country like Mexico. And what does that say about us and how we apportion wealth? I guess we shouldn't go there, but it says that a lot of children are not eating very well. And what does this mean when they're not eating very well? They get sick. They can't think. So I heard this great statistic from a woman who runs the WIC program in our town. So the people who have very little money spend their money along five priorities. The first one is rent. And rent also encompasses utilities. So the first one is keeping your house afloat. The second one, we're talking households, is childcare. Very expensive. Third is transportation. Four is clothes because you don't want to look poor. Five is food. So you're in a situation where you don't have very much money, and the fifth thing you spend money on is food. What kind of food are you going to get? Calorie dense, nutritionally thin. And we are experts at making that in the United States. We are the best there is in making this kind of crap. So what do we get for this? We get 1 out of 4 fourth graders having diabetes by the time, type 2 diabetes by the time they're 18. We get 66% of American adults being substantially overweight. 66%. And all the associated health costs with this. And as you said, kids don't learn. They underperform. Everything is bad. So we get high-quality food to people, right? We send this 15,000 pounds of food to the food bank, so we're attempting to deal with a bit of that nutritional side. More importantly, I would say, or just as importantly as the nutritional side of it, there's a change here that can happen around the culture of food. It's very difficult to change a person's culture of food. But the food we're giving people, you cannot just eat. You have to chop it, wash it, and the most important thing is you cook it. Think about what happens with cooking. As soon as you start chopping and washing, it's in your hands, right? You're looking at the food. You start thinking about the nature of the ingredients. You're going to reach for some oil. What kind of oil am I using? What kind of rice am I going to cook? Where is this coming from? All of a sudden, you start caring about the other ingredients than the ones are right in your hand. And you start caring about the whole totality of the meal you're making because you're making this meal for the other people who are in your household, who ostensibly you care for. And then you put this food on the table. The table serves as a gathering place. It pulls in food from all over, right? From maybe the CSA that sent it to you, or the food bank, or the grocery store. It's a locus, it's a nexus. It pulls in all this food. It also pulls in the people from the household. And it pulls in the ideas they have in their head as they start talking to each other. 50% of the money we spend on food is spent on food eaten outside of our homes. And half of that is eaten in cars. We get people to cook. They eat together in their house and start sharing about what they did during the day. I feel like getting good food to people isn't just nutritionally beneficial, but it's beneficial in helping to create a household cohesion. And if you have this house that's feeling cohesive and getting to know each other and starting to care about one another in tangible ways, they might treat this house a little differently. And they might treat this house a little differently. And pretty soon you have a neighborhood that might be functioning a little bit better. I realize I'm being somewhat idealistic here, but I really believe it can start with that table and the food that lands on that table. So community development through food. The second one, which is most pertinent to this group, is the experience of growing food. And I feel like when we look at the Pease Farm, or other student farms, or other civic farms that give food to food banks or other emergency food shelters, the metric is often, well, how many pounds of food did you create? And certainly that's fine as a nice measure. But I feel like the very most powerful thing we do, most powerful thing we produce, is the experience of growing food. The food, even though I just tried to passionately describe to you how wonderful it is like icing on the cake. The cake itself is the experience of growing food. So we work with privileged, middle-class white kids, not a population in need. You can laugh at that. But that's who comes to college in Montana, for the most part. However, these kids have spent most of their time at school learning about how bad the world is. They're environmental studies students, right? And what do they do to address this? They write well-thought-out and well-crafted papers for middle-aged people like me to read and hand back to them. And the world is not made better. These kids who have had all kinds of privilege, access to sports and violin lessons and being ferried around by their parents and having their self-esteem coddled, etc., have never, for the most part, actually been necessary. So the experience of growing food, I'm going to break it down to a really easy one. Weeding carrots, which Matt mentioned yesterday, can be absolutely heinous. I have a real issue with direct seeded crops, especially in a wet spring, and the weeds choke them out, and it's just horrible. So if we miss windows with the cultivating tractor, there we are on our hands and knees. I'm sure you've been in this heinous hell before. Weeding carrots, bad, right? But Kelly and I are weeding carrots across from one another. If you and I weeded carrots across from one another for 4 hours, by the end, we would know about each other's household. We would know where one another lived, bits and pieces of our background, how we got to this point. If we did this for 3 months, you and I would be friends. I'm absolutely certain of that. When you weed that bed of carrots, you step back from it, and you go, oh, that looks so much better. Matt pointed out on the tour yesterday, he was talking about legions of people moving through the field with hula hoes and how fantastic that was, because you could look one way and see this greenness between the rows of carrots, and you look the other way, and it's that beautiful brown soil. Instant, tangible results from your work. So you are on that hula hoe, or you are on your hands and knees weeding, and you can look back and go, I did that. And it's instantaneously obvious. The importance of it is instantaneously obvious. Why this was done, and most importantly, your personal effectiveness was instantaneously obvious. So, through this kind of work, you can sense and feel, much more sense, you can feel that you have the power to change things in the world. Ever so small, but you actually did it. You can look back on that row of carrots and say, they look clean and beautiful now. And a couple weeks later, a month later, you may be harvesting carrots and making beautiful bunches if you can learn to work a twist tie, which is challenging for people. And then the carrots go to the CSA or they go to the food bank. And you can feel all this on your shoulders. I did that. You see these beautiful carrots on the table. You did that. Way, way more rewarding than getting a paper back or handing a paper in. So the first part of that, personal effectiveness. The second part of it, Kelly and I became friends. We also became friends with Seth, who was working there too. And maybe if Jen was visiting, I would so love to have you guys out. By the end of 3 months of doing this, the little tribe of PE students, and they get credit for being there, and they're there a ton, they become a little family. The best part of my job is getting to watch 15 people fall in love with one another over the course of the summer. They're all wearing each other's sweatshirts because everyone leaves them there because it's cold in the morning and warm when they leave, and then they just pick another one up. The beginning of the season, they say, where do you want us to put the truck? And midway through, they say, we need to change the oil in our truck. Our carrots look weedy. Do you hear the change in pronouns? Deep ownership. So the two things that are happening here, one, people understand their personal effectiveness. Two, they belong to a larger group. And they are key to the success of that group. And these two things running together, personal effectiveness and belonging to a larger group, these two things are transformative. You put these things together. And people walk differently. They talk differently. They are changed by it. So my buddy Tim Ballard and I broke this down. He used to work with me at the farm. We broke this down into a recipe. If you take small groups of people, give them the opportunity to do humble work, and literally I mean humble, in the dirt, humble work that creates tangible results, you get a transformational experience. So if I'm going to put a name on that transformational experience, imagine this. You are fully bonded to the people around you. You understand, because you belong to this group, that their well-being and your well-being are all tied together. Your behavior towards them is as thoughtful as you can make it and as caring as you can make it, because you feel so bonded to them. And the soil under your feet, the same thing. You are bonded to the activity and bonded to the place. Your behavior toward that soil completely changed from what it would be in another context. You deeply care about it. You deeply care about the ground under your feet and deeply care about the people around you. That is sustainability. The light bulbs and the Priuses, that's just symptomatic. Really deeply believing that you are tied to the folks around you and to the ground under your feet, that is the mindset of sustainability. And possibly the best thing we can do at the farm where I work is create this for people. And it forever serves as a reference point. Whether they become farmers or not is not that important to me. What's really important to me is they take this experience and put it in another context, whether they're doing public health or education or whatever. This idea of our well-being as a shared thing and us having an allegiance to the ground under our feet, that's sustainability. And I don't think we can make it en masse. I think we have to make it little tiny places replicated all over. Replicated according to the social, cultural, and environmental parameters of wherever it happens to be. So, privileged white kids, great. Do they really need help? Well, giving them this experience of sustainability, I feel like, helps propel us all towards a better world, because these people are going to be in positions of power and change, whether they're making money or not. But my buddy Tim and I were talking one day. This was 4 years into the Peace Farm. It's now 15 years old. He'd been doing wilderness therapy with, out in Montana, we call this hoods in the woods. And we were having this conversation, trying to break down, what is it? Why is it these kids literally fall in love with one another every summer? And that they love the place. What's going on here? And we broke it down to this recipe, and we start talking about it more. And he said, you know, sure, it works for privileged white kids, but it wouldn't work for people who are facing a whole other set of obstacles. So he took some of the stuff from the wilderness therapy model, and we took our little recipe, and we created a program we called Youth Harvest. So we work with Missoula County. It's a Missoula Youth Drug Court. Drug court is not a courtroom, it's a program. And the kids who are in drug court have to satisfy a certain number of things to exit the program. One of the things they can do is do Youth Harvest. Youth Harvest, the name for it now, or the descriptor, the tagline, is that it's an employment-based therapeutic program. These kids are not in college. They're not buying credits. We pay them to be there. We pay them minimum wage. For the most of them, not only is this the first job they've ever had, but it makes them the big breadwinner in their household. Most of these kids live in youth homes or group homes. We have 3 to 5 of them. We don't have all 5 from drug court. We try and take 2, 3 from drug court, and then we try and get 2 other kids who are facing similar obstacles but are not in the juvenile justice system. And we really selectively pick these kids. They have to interview for the job. Especially those other 2 positions not in drug court, we really want people who bring a level of maturity to it. So we have 3 to 5 teenagers, and these kids get intermixed into the PEAS student community from day one. And if you were visiting and you were standing in the parking lot or just walking along the main line and you just saw bodies out there all about the same size, you wouldn't be able to tell who is who. We integrate the 2 groups. So you might say, Kelly, would you take these 3 people over there and start bunching scallions, and one of them could be a Youth Harvest kid, and 2 could be peace students. It doesn't matter. They intermix. One of the key elements to the summer program is that we eat lunch together. And this ties in just a second. So 2 kids stay inside our main barn building and cook food for everybody else. So this way we get to eat the food we've been growing, and much more importantly, we actually get to eat together, because it's not work. The Youth Harvest kids are integrated into this as well. They learn how to cook, and they eat with us. We're all part of the same thing. The one thing that they do differently is on CSA days in the afternoon, they take some of their food and they pack it up in this awesome big maroon panel van. Looks like a UPS van. Actually was a UPS van. We painted it maroon. And we put this really great logo on the back, and I might take my shirt off with the t-shirt on. I'll show you the logo at the end. And they pack up this van with beautiful food, and they take it off to low-income housing for seniors. 2 big obstacles face seniors in their effort to get good food. One is price, and the other is transportation. So we bring the food to them, and then we cut the price in about half, sometimes less than half. And they use their senior coupons that they get for using at farmers market, or they can use EBT. So they're paying $1 for a bundle of carrots, $1 for a bundle of beets, 50 cents for a handful of tomatoes. So you have these 2 marginalized populations, and they create ecological niches, social niches for one another. You have one set of people over here that need dramatically to be needed. The kids in Youth Harvest, they are extraneous to our society. They are ones we have to deal with. Think how you feel when you are needed. They show up at the senior centers, and you have ladies coming out in their walkers as fast as they can go to get the tomatoes. And who's on the other side of the table but some kid who was stealing car stereos and smoking weed? And she calls him by name. And he says, how are you doing? and they talk about tomato preserving. This should bring tears to your eyes. It's awesome. The Youth Harvest kids do this. We call it mobile market. And our plan is to try and expand to more mobile markets. But it's really important to me that we keep the Youth Harvest population small within the Peace Farm students. These kids are a bunch of them in the juvenile justice system. And when they arrive, they are not so much defiant as they are deeply cynical about everything. And they have really good reason to be. Most of them, all of them actually, that I've dealt with, are guilty most of all of having really crappy families. And they do not have a lot of hope for the world or any reason to believe in anything good. The white kids of privilege are just the opposite. Full of optimism, super enthusiastic, ready to go. We want that to be the cultural tenor of the place. So by having a small population of Youth Harvest kids, they have to immerse themselves in that culture. They have to rise to that. There are too few of them to create anything different. And we split them up. So they get infected with that wonderful culture. Another great thing that happens there with this is that we get natural mentorships happening, and I'm not trying to make a pun. These mentorships happen organically. You could not create this. You could not cast it out. It just happens. It happens mostly with women, and I'm not sure why, where we have 16, 17-year-old young women really bonding with 22-year-olds. And this is super important in a very tangible way, not just because that friendship is great and knowing someone a little older than you is good, especially knowing somebody who believes in a different kind of world than you and you come to admire them. These kids are at a very transitional age. They are about to leave their group home. And what are they going to do next? Missoula is a tough place in that the cost of living is high and wages are low. You get a part-time job at minimum wage, you cannot afford a place to live. It's pretty straight up. You get a full-time job at minimum wage, maybe you can afford a place to live, but like I said, food's going to be rough. Maybe you're not going to be able to pay your utility bills. It's really hard. But if you have a friend who has a couch and she is a really good person and you can sleep on her couch or get 20 bucks from her or get a ride or get advice, that's really, really good. Because these kids I'm talking about do not have the family safety net that I imagine most everyone in this room probably enjoyed. So these mentorships turn out to be really tangibly important. 2 years ago, a woman named Hannah, now she's in her 20s, she had been a Youth Harvest kid. She came to the Peace Farm for her wedding. So I said, how often do people return to the scene of their juvenile justice experience for their wedding? So this transformational experience that I'm talking about comes from, just to reiterate, this sense of belonging to a community larger than yourself, to a feeling of being personally powerful, to seeing tangible results from the good work that you do. And that is the experience of growing food together. I have a deep background in farming on our own. I live on a farm with my family. My wife runs it. It's a whole other story. But after doing this for years and years, I can say farming, like food, is best shared. The experience of farming, even more so than the food, I feel like is the best thing we produce. Though, as I said earlier, the food can be really important. So the third way we connect with the community, see, I'm staying on track. It feels like I'm rambling, but I'm not. The third way is to the community at large, because this is a public project. We're on public land. We exist by the good graces of the other people of Missoula. How do we touch them? By being so public. It's a great book. Lots of great books out there. A great book that I'm talking about is called A Garlic Testament. Do you know this one? By Stanley Crawford. Highly recommended. He's a garlic grower in northern New Mexico. Beautiful book. He kind of chronicles what he does through the year with what he's thinking about. And he's a really smart guy. And he's kind of funny. He says that everybody, it's in us. All of us need to have some connection with where our food comes from. It's this sense of fundamental, knowing and feeling what is fundamental to us. We all need it in some slim way. We also all need to belong to a larger group. By having this farm be so public, there's a bike path right next to it. It's on a major road to a neighborhood. We're surrounded by hills that on both sides are public land, and they're hiked in and biked in often. The farm's very visible. People are on that bike path, and they stop and look through the fence and say to me, "Is this rain messing with you?" I'm like, "Yeah," and we talk about the rain. They got to do farmer talk for a moment. And in their heads, in their hearts, they have a bit more connection to food. They go up on the hill and they can see where we are during the season and comment on that. Not to mention that we have a big party the third Thursday in August, because the school district only lets us have alcohol one day a year. Think how lucky you are. Imagine that. So we have a big party. This year we had 750 people come to our party. We had live music. We grilled 750 organic beef burgers from my buddy Ernie's farm down the way. And we made carrot salad, green salad, roast, and roasted beets for 750 people. 750 people came to the party. More than 2,500 kids came on field trips. We have an education program through the nonprofit, and we come up with the money to bus kids up there from the Missoula County Public School District to come out on field trips. These are kids, for the most part, that, like most kids in America, don't like things that are green, but they will gladly bite into a carrot that they just pulled out of the ground and wipe the dirt on their pants, or eat a piece of raw kale. We have 4 farm camps a summer. I was selling food at my family's stand at Farmer's Market earlier this summer, and there's an actual conversation, a kid and a mom, and the mom says, "What is that, that red stuff?" "Purple." And this kid says, "Oh, that's kale." And the mom goes, "Kale?" And the kid goes, "Yeah, that's what you eat when you're having a bad day." And I said, I just stopped and I said, "You went to farm camp." So everybody knows what CSA is, right? Community Supported Agriculture. I don't like that. It sounds like if we don't all get together, this feeble thing won't make it. We have to support this thing because we think it's a good idea. This public farm, a civic farm, a farm where, that is using the experience of growing food and the food itself and its public nature to further the betterment of the town, flips that acronym on its head. We have agriculturally supported our community. Our farm is embedded in the cultural fabric of our town and helps deeply to make our town feel like our town, not like every other place. And I believe all of you who are associated with a student farm, it's somewhat public, can do just this in your own way according to the social and cultural environmental parameters of where you are. What I'm offering here is no recipe, just a general set of themes. It has to be designed locally, obviously. Agriculturally supported community. That's the gist of all this. I don't know what time it is, but that's what I was going to do. And then I had 2 other things for you. I would answer questions, and I was just going to let the pictures kind of go loop-de-loop as opposed to the standard PowerPoint model. And what we can do, we can turn the pictures on, and we can answer questions at the same time. One thing I guess I forgot to say at the beginning of this, I wanted to, especially for the students and teachers in this group who are involved in student farms, I guess it's mostly everybody, give a little super tight couple sentences on the structure of our farm in terms of education. The heart of it is in the summer. Students get 6, they earn 6 credits. It starts the Monday after finals week is over and ends the Friday before school starts, the whole summer, because that's farming, right? We're not going to do first summer session and take 2 weeks off. No, it's the whole darn summer. Students work Monday through Thursday from 8 to noon. We have 15 students, 9.75 acres, a small orchard, a bunch of that's in cover crop. Students work 8 to noon. Monday and Thursday we harvest for CSA. They do all the work that takes to be on the, to run the farm. I am right there. I'm not in an office. My office is the farm. I don't even have an office on campus. Each day, 2 students go into our main building. We call it a barn, but it doesn't actually house animals. It's our farm center. And cook lunch for everybody else. On Fridays, everyone comes back to the farm, and we have a sit-in-a-circle class. And I talk about bugs or weeds or soil or something like that. And then We get in a university van and we go visit another farm. We're rich in small farms, not nearly as rich as PA is, but really good for Western Montana, especially compared to 30 years ago. And we go visit another farm where people are doing it for a livelihood. And these folks are super great at letting us into their lives, and students ask good questions, and they answer. They talk about how much money they make, and how the stress is of living out in the country, what the stress is about working 7 days a week, or how do you have your children be part of it, and why did you make the cultivation decisions you did? All of it gets answered. And they pay for this experience. That's summertime. Spring and fall, students only work 6 hours a week. And they get to pick a section. They can work Monday, Wednesday morning, Monday, Wednesday afternoon, Tuesday, Thursday morning, Tuesday, Thursday afternoon. And all the students in all four sections come to the farm at 4 o'clock on Wednesdays, and we have another sit in a circle class, and I do just this. And we talk about what we're doing. Spring and fall, I feel like, are much weaker than summer. But spring and fall, they also have to take other classes. It's about a 15-minute, we say, Seth, about 15-minute bike ride from campus, a little slower going up, much faster coming down because it's downhill. Spring and fall, they just get a taste of that experience of community, that experience of sustainability. But we have a very high rate of recidivism. We have a lot of students coming back. That's a joke. You know what recidivism means? It's when you look it up. Okay, I think that's enough background. I have no idea if I'm under, over, or... Okay, we're okay? Okay, so please let me know you remained awake through that and ask me a question. Jen? No, very good question. So, like I said, the farm runs in partnership with a nonprofit. I'm the only full-time person sent there by the university. However, each semester I get two graduate student TAs. They don't get the full TA-ship that other TAs get, but they get a little chunk of money, and they get really great teaching experience. So it's not hard to find these folks. And I pick them, and sometimes they're undergraduates. It's not always graduates. If they're really good and they're really into it, they get rewarded with that. The nonprofit runs an education program, as I described, with the kids and the Youth Harvest program. So those adults are also there. The education guy has an assistant. They have some other things going on in town, so they're not always there, but they're there often. The Youth Harvest person has an assistant, and they're there most of the time. Garden City Harvest, the nonprofit, has three other neighborhood farms and has an operations director who manages the infrastructure, kind of fixes things at those places. He also, his home base is the Pease Farm, but he kind of goes out. And the farm has a caretaker. We have animals, we have chickens and pigs. Irrigation is also a huge deal for us. It's a very dry climate, so we can't run on banker's hours. There has to be a human presence Saturday and Sunday and in the evenings. So we built an apartment over the kitchen in our building. So there's a caretaker that's there as well. So we have a little crew of folks that are there more or less full time. Good question. So let me reiterate your question, because they're recording this. Not, you said it beautifully, but I'll just got to say it for the tech folks. So basically, you asked, I shouldn't get your name, sorry. Stephanie. I wish I could read it from here. So what Stephanie asked is, what's the strategy about starting these community gardens, and how do we deal with, if I'm paraphrasing, some of the cultural obstacles where community gardening may seem like something people of privilege do, gardening is recreation, compared to something that's sustainable and helps us sustainable in a way that literally sustains us, that you need to do for your food. So what we did was we strategically located community gardens in low-income neighborhoods. And then we have a garden manager. We also set aside a certain portion of ground at these community gardens that where we grow food for the food bank, so people have this volunteer for veggies option. And then we just dive in and start and make it beautiful. And this sounds like a weak answer, but if you make it beautiful, they will come. And we don't have the place flooded with white kids of privilege making arugula. It's not that at all. We have one person starting to grow food and trim up the outside and build a fence and just make it look beautiful. And people do come. And then we hand over management of that garden to a leadership team made up of people who are gardeners there. And we found that when we've tried to put community gardens where people would say, oh, I have this great 2 acres, you should come and use that. If it's in the wrong part of town, they won't go. It's got to be right, literally next to where people live, because as you just pointed out, they don't have very much time. So we just did it, put it right next to where they live, made it beautiful, and kind of stepped back. The garden manager is there with tools, advice. We have seeds. Sometimes we have extra starts from the peas farm or some other farms. Basically, they let it rip. And the character of the community garden is really created by the people who are there, and somewhat by that leadership team, but really by the people who are there. And it works. Once it starts to look nice, it takes off. And it's led by children. Kids from the trailer park come there because it's beautiful and it's open and there's grass to play on. And then the parents follow. We have a final exam.
And what's the structure of that?
So each week I do a talk and we have a reader. And the final exam comes out of the talk and the talks and the reader and some of the field trips. Which this is going on behind me, like that was a field trip. That's not fun. That's to north central Montana. And we went to a grain farm and then we slept there. So that's where the final exam comes from. It's not as academic as it could be, but I've tried to make it more academic, didn't work. So we put together a crop manual, and so there's a section on every crop. That's in the reader, and it isn't supposed to be universal. It's, this is how we grow salad mix here. So it goes right back to the field. And then I do talks on larger issues. Like I said, I do bugs, weeds, soil, tractors, irrigation, all of that. And when we created that reader, led really by a graduate student a few years ago. Before that, I just used other people's articles, but I got frustrated because the way it was described in the article wasn't how we did it, so it wasn't really helping the students with their own work. Okay, I couldn't quite hear you said, in terms of bringing what students?
A diversity of students to the farm. What makes people, what can make people feel more comfortable?
Man, that's a good question. To bring a diversity of students to the farm, what makes them more comfortable? That's your question, right? Gosh, it isn't something I've addressed. We don't have a rich racial diversity at the University of Montana. We don't even have a very rich cultural or class diversity. So it hasn't come up as an issue, but the farm is well known. It's open. Everyone's welcome. It has a really good reputation. I mean, that's somewhat of a weak answer, but it fits our context. If we were in a place that was more racially diverse and we found only students of one type going there, it would be something we would have to address, but it hasn't been an issue, so we haven't addressed it. I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer. Last thing I could say is you're all invited. If you're ever very far from here in the west, western Montana is really beautiful. I don't know if you're getting a glimpse of that from these pictures. The Pease Farm is a really nice place. You're all welcome. Anybody would come out, I would roll out the red carpet for you. Again, I'm not sure where we are on time. Okay, so thank you very much.